I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Hey, I'm Adam Carolla.
Hi, my name is Penn Jillette.
Not only listening, I'm the guest.
I'm a Penn and Teller, and I am the fourth listener.
And I am the fourth listener.
And that must make me at least the fourth listener.
To keep our three listeners coming back, we must be doing something right. And if you're the fourth listener, we thank you for the support. You can get every episode with no ads at patreon.com/DavidCSmalley and take advantage of your fourth listener status.
And we're going to sue David Smalley for slander.
With a world divided, it's time to resurrect nuance and remember the importance of conversation. He's an actor, he's a comedian, and he'll make you think. This is David C. Smalley.
Yes, it is. Welcome. Welcome to the podcast. Michael's here in the flesh. Michael, it's good to see you.
Good to see you.
You're fully vaccinated.
I'm full vax.
I'm partial vax.
What are you again?
Pfizer.
Oh, I wish I knew that before I came over. I don't actually associate with Pfizer's.
Oh, are you a Moderna?
I'm Moderna. I figured this out today. This is a visual, so sorry, listeners. But
Okay.
Moderna for life.
Okay, gang signs.
Gang signs.
Okay, well, I can't do a P and an F together, so. Yeah. That's so cheesy.
Yeah.
Very Silver Lake-y of you, though.
Thank you.
Yeah. I got the Pfizer vaccine, and I just want to, real quick, before we bring the guest on. My experience was, first of all, anyone who's afraid of needles or afraid of the shot, I truly do not understand it. I literally did not feel a thing. I'm not saying it was a tiny poke. I'm not saying it was slightly painful. I did not know when they gave me the shot. So if that's one of your worries, please, just two people passed out. They were teenagers. They passed out, and I was going, oh my God, what's in this damn vaccine? They pass out, and then the nurse walks over to the mother who's like supporting the head of the passed out 16-year-old, and she said, how long has it been since she got the vaccine? And the mom goes, she hasn't had it yet.
That's Pfizer folk for you, though. I hate to say it. This is why us Modernas. I mean, I don't want to keep bringing this up, but Pfizer folk, they're like that.
We're a little weaker bunch, I think.
Yeah.
And then someone else got rushed over to a hospital bed. And I was like, oh God, what happened? And I heard them talking, and they asked the girl who was, I say passed out. They were like leaning over and moaning and feeling faint. And when they would ask them questions about the vaccine, it turns out they're still in line. They're just nervous about the needle.
Yeah.
That's really what was happening.
Yeah.
So the reason I ended up getting Pfizer is Talissa has to get it. It's for 16 and up. And so, yeah, I got the junior vaccine, I guess. There were tons of adults there. A lot of adults got it. But I couldn't get an appointment. Talissa found an appointment available. She booked it. So I went with her. Her appointment was legit and booked, and then I just kept begging for an extra vaccine in line with her. They were like, nope, can't do it. Nope, can't do it. Wait around. Come back later. So I just stood there until the line went down. I went and got to the back of the line, and I said, do you have any left over? And they were like, oh, you need to sign up on this list. And they handed me the list. There were 17 people on the list waiting for a vaccine. So I sign up. I'm number 18. And in about 10 minutes, they walk over and go, everybody's getting a vaccine. By the way, we have a lot left over. Call your friends. Tell them to come get vaccinated. We have to throw them out because we thawed them today. And apparently what's happening is people are either not showing up to their second dose, or they're booking three or four different appointments to try to get the earliest one. And then when they get the one sooner, they just go get that one and don't call to cancel the other appointments. I did that. I had one scheduled for April 29th. And then when I went with Talissa, she got hers. And that afternoon I came home, called Kaiser, and canceled my vaccine appointment because I'm not a dick.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing to do. So,
right. Well, a lot of Pfizer people aren't quite up to your caliber, like I said.
They have about the same efficacy, right? I've heard fewer side effects with Pfizer.
Yeah. Moderna, as we discussed previously, got me sick on the second dose.
Yeah. How sick were you?
One day out of the
feverish chills.
Okay. Kind of out for the count for about 24 hours.
Okay. My first dose of Pfizer did nothing. No. Like, I felt absolutely fine. In fact, it took 3 or 4 hours for my arm to even start getting sore. And I looked it up and they were like, just keep it moving, stay active, do a little workout with your arm or something and you'll feel better. So I did. I stretched it and kept my arm moving. And then like 4 or 5 hours later, I was drinking a beer on my couch. Like, I don't know. I can't believe people are putting so much into fighting this when it's, I don't know.
Yeah, but they believe that there's 5G and microchips and Bill Gates and the CIA.
Yeah, right, so. Right. Maybe our guest today thinks that too. Let's bring him on.
Let's find out.
Let's find out and talk to him. Join me in welcoming James Inman to the show. It's his first time ever on the podcast. We met out in Kansas City. How are you, buddy?
Fine.
So I met you out in Kansas City. You are one of the stars of the Unbookables film. Can I call you a friend of Doug Stanhope? Yeah. Are you guys still getting along? Does he still abuse you? Does he still abuse you regularly?
Yeah, we can't break up. I swear to God, we can't break up.
You've tried.
It's a long. It's complicated.
It seems to me that with Doug, you guys have a love-hate relationship. You love him, and he hates you.
Well, yeah. I mean, he likes being. He likes the, you know, the push and pull, and he likes to have somebody around to you know, call his bullshit, you know, which I do that. Most he doesn't like ass kissers, you know.
Well, very cool. So, well, we have a lot to get into on this. I sent out a tweet the other day that you responded to disagreeing with me. I definitely want to get into that. You and I both experienced unique situations with death recently, and we're going to address that. So there's going to be a little bit of an uncomfortable piece of this, but we have to face it head on. And before we do, I want to take a moment to share some info about this new podcast I found. It's called True Underdog. It just got launched by Jason Waller. He's a 4-time Entrepreneur of the Year Award winner. It's real. It's motivational. It's raw. Please go check it out. Go subscribe. If you're looking for inspiring stories and killer advice for being an entrepreneur, you gotta head over and subscribe. Jason Waller is the definition of a true underdog. He was raised in a trailer park, suffered childhood abuse, was kicked out of high school, and became a father as a teenager. And after struggling to support his family, hearing no, you can't, there's no way that's ever gonna happen, he found the power inside his own self, used his street smarts, started 3 companies from the ground up, and one of them is on path to becoming a billion-dollar enterprise called Power Home Solar. You can also look that up. So I don't know about you, but when I hear billion-dollar, I get motivated already. And trust me when I tell you, this guy's energy is contagious. So head over to True Underdog Podcast now to hear Jason and his high-profile guest turn their lives around to achieve massive success. Subscribe to True Underdog Podcast using Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you steal your favorite podcasts. I want to tell a story first, something that happened yesterday. And I keep seeing this. I don't know how much you are on TikTok or social media, but, you know, I keep seeing these videos of a guy being a creep, right? And, you know, he's just like walking behind a woman, give me your number, yo, talk to me, give me your number. And she's filming. She's like, no, leave me alone. No, leave me alone. This guy's clearly a douchebag. He's pissing me off. I'm a single dad to a 16-year-old daughter. I know what she goes through. And I'm getting pissed off at it. And then, of course, in the comments, it's like all men, male curfew 2021, men are garbage. Uh-huh. And I see that and I go, well, come on. And as soon as I speak up and say, no, you know, that guy pisses me off too, not all men. You're missing the point. Your male fragility, your male tears. And then it just becomes bullying. And I'm like, we can't do that. You know, it's just these guys that are acting this way are highly pissing me off. Like infuriating. Mm-hmm. It's happened a couple of times in person. And I see what the women are talking about, that they feel like it's everywhere all the time, right? Mm-hmm. But all the hundreds of men you pass every day that aren't trying to dry hump you and get your Snapchat, those are the guys that are probably being, you know, respectful. So I'm not in favor of lumping everyone into a category, but I'm seeing more and more men be absolute creeps. I mean, flat out pieces of shit. To the point that last night was the first time in 20 years I actually almost got into a physical altercation with a stranger in public. And here's what happened. I took my daughter bowling. And first of all, let me back up. We were driving the other day. She just got her license. She was in front of me and we were on the phone. I wanted to make sure she knew how to get to the new place. Hollywood is not an easy place to learn to drive around. And so she's in front of me. It's nice out. We're driving through the neighborhoods and both of our windows are down. No. My windows are down. Hers are up. This guy, she stops at a red light. This guy's next to her and she's on the phone with me, but he doesn't know it. And she goes, oh, there's this guy, this guy slowed down and let her get over or whatever. She's like, oh, that guy that let me over is waving at me. And I was like, oh, that's nice. She goes, wait, he's telling me to put my window down.
Oh, no.
And I was like, you probably don't want to do that. She goes, what if something's wrong with the car? So she rolls the window down and I hear him through her speakers and my window go, you are so beautiful, baby. And she's like, she goes, okay. 16, by the way. She goes,
oh my God.
She goes, oh, okay, thank you. And starts to roll the window up. And he's like, yo, hold on. Let me get your number.
Oh no.
She shakes her head no and rolls the window up.
Oh, jeez.
The light turns green. We are on the left turn only. He's supposed to go straight. He puts his blinker on and starts trying to get over behind her.
Oh no. Oh God.
I sped up and blocked him from coming in the lane. He honks at me, gets mad, and has to go straight at the light. We turn left and head toward our place. I'm going, what if I wasn't there? What if he would have... You're telling me this asshole is just going to follow her home? I was furious. Like, part of me... of course, her safety is number one. But part of me is like, I kind of wish he would have. And then... popped out, her father is behind you. You absolute this dude. This dude was clearly in his late 20s, early 30s. Yelling at a 16-year-old girl for her phone number and and when she says no and rolls up the window, tries to get behind her to follow her. I was that really pissed me off. But there's nothing I can do about it. He's gone. We're in the car. I'm obviously a father watching this go down going, God,
oh my God,
all the time she goes, hey dad, I'm going to run to the store. I'll be right back. That shit plays over in my head. So last night we're bowling several miles from here. And, there's this couple next to us, this Hispanic couple. The woman is really tiny. The guy is pretty large. He's probably 6'3", kind of a wide build or whatever. A little bit of a beer belly, but you can tell he's a big guy. And he's bowling like absolute shit. I mean, terrible. They're having a good time. They're drinking. I'm a decent bowler. It's kind of my main hobby. I absolutely love it. So we start talking, and he tells me that they have a bet that they're doing. Like if she beats him, he has to clean the air fryer. And if, you know, whatever, they have this bet. So they obviously like live together. Right. And so I start giving him tips. I'm trying to help him. So I'm showing him things. I'm showing him what to do with the ball. I'm giving him tips or whatever. And then they finish. He loses. He was terrible. And I said, man, I feel bad that I gave you bad advice. I guess I'll come to the place and clean the air fryer for you. He's like, hey, we need to schedule that. And he was being so cool, so down to earth, very nice. His girlfriend or his wife or whatever goes to the bathroom, which is right behind our lane. I walk up and bowl because it's my turn. And it's really quick. I grab the ball. I throw it. I get a strike. I'm done. I come back. And he's gone. And he walks away. And Talissa goes, that guy asked for my number. And at first, like, it took me a second to even believe what had happened because we were talking. She had mentioned a really nice looking like teenage boy down the way a few lanes. So I'm going, that guy, that the cute boy asked for your number. I was about to be like, hey, awesome. Or are you cool? Did you give it to him? Or I was trying to be like, oh, is this a good thing? And she goes, no, the guy we were just talking to. And I'm going, I was in complete shock. I was like, no, oh, not man. That, not that. This guy was like mid to late 30s. I go, this, that, the guy in the white shirt? She goes, yeah. I said, what did he do? What do you mean? And she goes, when you turned around to throw your ball, he tried to give me his phone and it was already in the, from the contacts. He wanted my name and number. And I said to him, well, you want his number? And pointed to you. And he goes, no, you. And she goes, I said, why my number? And he goes, never mind. And he walked away real fast. And I said, he didn't leave. I said, he didn't leave. He went to the bathroom. She goes, oh, I thought he left. And I was like, no, no, he's here. So I walked out of the little bowling pit and stood in front of the bathroom and waited on him. Oh, and a lot of time went by. And I was like, shit, maybe he did leave. I don't know. So I walk back down into the pit. I grab a ball. I start the bowl. And I see him come out of the bathroom. So he comes out of the bathroom and makes a beeline for the door. His girl had already come out of the bathroom and left. So the bowling alley's full of people. I see him walking out. I throw the ball down and I start running toward him. And I go, hey, dude, hey. And he turns around and stops and looks at me. And in front of everybody, I said, did you just ask for my daughter's phone number? And you want to see a very large grown man become an absolute puppy dog. He looked terrified. He goes, that was your daughter? I said, she's 16, dude. And he goes, oh man, I didn't know. I thought it was your girlfriend.
Oh God. Oh,
and then I was like, wait, I've been sitting here helping you and talking to you, and you thought it was my girlfriend. And when I turned my back for one ball, you asked for her phone number?
God damn.
He was literally trembling. Like, I'm looking up at this guy. His hands are vibrating. He goes, I'm so sorry, man. I'm so sorry, man. I said, what is it about you that you think this is okay? He starts looking around. Everyone's staring at us. It's dead silent. No one is bowling. He's shaking. And he just goes, I'm really sorry, man. I'm so sorry. I just want to go. And I said, aren't you married? He goes, I'm not married. We're just, but I'm so sorry, bro. I'm so sorry.
Oh my God.
And I'm standing here in this moment and I'm going, part of me wants to go, well, let's go out to the car and see what your girl thinks about this. Uh-huh. Right. Yeah. Another part of me wants to just slap the absolute dog shit out of him and start fighting with him. I had zero fear. I was filled with so much anger. I get how people go to jail in these moments. I wasn't thinking about consequences or jail time. I was infuriated that a 30-something year old man just asked for my 16-year-old daughter's phone number when I turned my back. I was so angry. And he was just trembling and kept apologizing. And I thought for a brief moment, I want to give him something to think about. I want to get in his head. I could punch him. I could slap him. We could both get handcuffs on us. I want to give him something to think about. And in that quick moment, rather than going to the level of violence, I just said, I don't know how you sleep at night. You need to just be a better person. And he looked down at the ground and I said, be a man, dude, like an actual grown man, be a better person. And I said it again. And he goes, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sorry. I said, if I see you in here again, I'm telling your girl exactly what you did.
Oh man.
And I turned around and walked away. And he walked out and I looked up and there was probably 40 people staring at us. And a couple people walked over like, what happened? I said, he asked for my daughter's phone number. She's 16 years old. And they were like, oh, we'll keep an eye out for him. The guy behind the counter walks over and writes his name down because he had his name for the reservation on the lane. So I don't know if the guy's going to be allowed back or what, but I was so close to not even being able to do this show because I may have been in jail last night. I have not been that mad at a stranger ever.
And that happened yesterday? Ever.
That was last night. Yeah.
Last night. Oh my God.
Yeah. I mean, what analyze that situation, guys, both of you. I want to know what I've talked enough. I want to know, how do you think you would react in that situation?
I don't know how I'd react. But I think you go ahead.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, James.
Who?
You.
I would have done the same thing, but I usually I'm way more verbal, but I mean, I think what you said to him probably was pretty good. I mean, I would have just went off on him because my bark is worse than my bite. And usually, I mean, I could threaten people. Like, I could scare the fuck out of them with what I say. But yeah, I know what you're talking about. I mean, I haven't been in a fight since grade school, you know, which is weird because as a comedian, I say fucked up shit all the time, you know, but yeah, it's good that you didn't get into it. But if the cops came, I think they would have understood. If you told them, hey, he was hitting on my daughter, yeah, any cop would probably let you go, even if
yeah,
you
hit the guy's ass. I thought about that after the fact. And I also realized in that moment, regardless of the size difference, first of all, I do have a background in MMA and Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I'm not terribly concerned about that. I fought bigger guys a million times. But it was the sheer and absolute anger that I was feeling and the embarrassment and terrified feeling he was giving off that I was like, this was much more of a adult child scolding than it was two people angry at each other. Mm-hmm. If he had popped off something right, like, bro, she's hot, I want to bang that out, I wouldn't be here right uh-huh. now. Like, yeah, that's how close uh-huh. it was. It was his demeanor of being so apologetic made me go, in a split second, maybe I should take the shame route. And him being embarrassed uh-huh. by this publicly and then being shamed. Yeah. And in the moment when uh-huh. I could have done anything, I said to him, be a better person. I sincerely hope he thought about that last night and thinks about uh-huh. it every damn day. But my concern yeah. is someone who's going to ask for a 16-year-old girl's phone number while his girlfriend is in the bathroom and her father is bowling 8 feet from her. I don't know uh-huh. that he's got a conscience. Like, that's my concern with this.
Oh, man.
Michael?
I mean, you started this off by saying that sometimes you see postings where people are like, all men are, and you're like, not all men.
Right.
What did this do to your thinking on that? This seems to have, I think this moved maybe, the needle a little closer
of course
to
it did,
all
but
men.
I'm going, am I the only one left? Am I the only one not hitting
on
children?
Left, but
it's mind blowing.
Yeah.
How absolutely.
It speaks to
brash and creepy. It's just, it's like, it's that normal. Like, she would be down for that. Like, yeah, let me sneak my phone number into your, like, what a piece of shit. I just, it blows me away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it almost speaks to an insecurity though, because I've only come across this character a few times in my life and their heart seemed like the saddest little man I ever met. I remember one time I was at a bar with a beautiful girl and we went into a photo booth and we're getting funny photos taken with us. And I could see this guy in a muscle tee kind of come over and he was like staring at us and staring at her. We came out, he was literally like flexing, like showing off his muscles in a muscle tee. And he was like, he said something to her like, you want to see what a real man's like? You want to see what a real man's like or something like that? And she was just like, dude, get away from me. And like we walked away, but I was like, did that guy think that would work? Like, for one, look at me. If she's attracted to a dude that looks like me, there's little yeah. chance.
I think it worked in Tom and Jerry.
Yeah.
Like, the handsome cat would just yeah. show up with a big chest and get the girl. I think you're right. There's something about a guy that would do something like that. There's a, because he had a very, you could tell he was very, very weak. I mean, he was extremely weak. He was terrified. He was shaking just by being confronted by an adult. He just couldn't handle the confrontation, which is probably why he intentionally seeks out teenage girls to talk to. And, you know, I don't know. I'm part of me is regretting now. I don't know that I did enough. Like I kind of now wish I would have gone out to the parking lot and found his girlfriend and been like, he just asked for my daughter's phone number. She's 16 years old. Uh-huh. Like, I wish I would have continued the embarrassment, but I don't know. When you have a situation like that, we all have things we say we'll do differently or, you know, but I don't know, man. I really wanted to hit this guy. I mean, I more than anyone ever in my life, yeah, I really know. Wanted to hurt yeah. this person.
But it's so. A special kind of sad little man that would hit on a girl with her boyfriend right there. And like I said, I've only met this character a
right.
few times
right.
in many years, a guy that would walk up and go, come on, what are you doing with that guy? I mean, because I'm not intimidating, let's be honest. Like, so it has happened dude has thought, there's no physical consequence from walking up and talking and saying this to that girl because that guy couldn't even make a
oh,
fist.
Oh, so he thought I was going to put up with it. He thought I was.
I'm talking about me.
I think you're yeah. onto something. I think he probably thought, oh, this guy's short and old. And if she's into older guys, I'm better looking.
Yeah.
So she'll definitely like me. And then when I checked his ass in front of everybody, he was like, oops, wrong one. This one will hit me. This one will say something.
Yeah.
And and that's exactly what he needed to feel. Probably, he needed to know.
He probably thought you were her boyfriend or something. I mean, you know, you're pretty young looking. I mean,
I don't know about that.
It's I mean, personally, I'm kind of amazed that you have a daughter that's 16 years old. You know, Emery, I think his daughter is something like 25 or something.
Yeah, Emery looks like he's in his 30s, and the guy's in his 50s.
Emery, he's my age, but he doesn't look my age.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Anyway, I haven't talked about that yet, and I can't stop thinking about it. Like, I have so many regrets, and I have I wish I would have gone harder and louder. No, and you know what I mean?
You did the right thing.
I thought, I've even thought maybe if I had even, you know, just scooped him up with a little wrestling slam and punched him in his head a few times and then let him leave, that'll deter future behavior. Like,
Probably has had his ass kicked several times, because it sounds to me like that's probably happened to him before. Like, hey dude, that is my daughter, because you're telling me that he already realized he fucked up. I mean, he fucked up to begin with. Even if you were just the boyfriend, he's still fucking up.
Right.
I
mean, exactly.
It's like, goddamn.
Right. It's such a bizarre.
I've been consumed.
The needle, but the needle definitely moved.
Like, yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Maybe it's okay. Not all men, but can we come up with that? Like 97% of men. Can that be the hashtag? Because I'm having a hard time not seeing creeps now. Like, it's everywhere.
They are everywhere.
Yeah, I mean, you know, how many daughter? How many kids do you have?
Just one. My daughter. Well, that's part of the. I mean, I lost my son in November. He died in a motorcycle accident.
Oh, that's right.
But she's my only kid biologically.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. But it's, I mean, I'm glad there's only one daughter. I got to tell you. I mean, I worry about it.
I have no idea. I don't have any kids, so I have no idea what it would be like.
I've definitely been consumed with revenge fantasies, though, after some creep or some jerk. I had a confrontation with them the night before, and the entire next day. And when I say fantasy, they have to be fantasies, because in the fantasy, I can fight. But like, I've spent easily 24 to 48 hours after being confronted by some jerk at a bar or something like that, just consumed with, oh, I wish I'd picked him up over my head and thrown him out the window. And I just can't stop fantasizing about beating the hell out of some guy. So I know where you're at.
Yeah, but I think, honestly, in this, I don't know. I was so mad yesterday, man. Size wouldn't have mattered one bit. I was absolutely infuriated. So, yeah, I don't know, man. I had to get that off my chest. All right. How are you on the vaccine, James? Are you a vaccinated guy, or you think they're implanting us with 5G? What's your deal there?
I'm vaccinated. I got the other one. Oh, cool. The other one is coming at the end of April.
Wait, we got to figure out, which gang are you in? Are you in the
Moderna?
He didn't
have a choice. I mean, the place that I went to, you know, they're just like, it's going to be Moderna, and that's just the
Up, James. They said he's Moderna
beggars
material.
Can't be choosers. I'm like, you know, I'm just happy that they have.
You know, look at me and go, this is the kind of guy that would
give him Pfizer.
That his daughter could get hit on by a 30-something year old man. This guy wouldn't even punch him. We're giving him Pfizer. So they knew ahead of time that I wouldn't hit the guy.
Somebody, I heard somewhere where there's places where you could choose which one you want.
Yeah. Yeah, if you call your regular doctor or your insurance and they schedule it, they don't usually tell you. They just schedule your availability based on your area. Uh-huh. Yeah. All right, man, we got a lot to get into. So before we do, I want to take a moment to share some info about this new podcast I found. It's called True Underdog. It just got launched by Jason Waller. He's a 4-time Entrepreneur of the Year Award winner. It's real. It's motivational. It's raw. Please go check it out. Go subscribe. If you're looking for inspiring stories and killer advice for being an entrepreneur, you got to head over and subscribe. Jason Waller is the definition of a true underdog. He was raised in a trailer park, suffered childhood abuse, was kicked out of high school, and became a father as a teenager. And after struggling to support his family, hearing no, you can't, there's no way that's ever going to happen, He found the power inside his own self, used his street smarts, started three companies from the ground up, and one of them is on path to becoming a billion-dollar enterprise called Power Home Solar. You can also look that up. So I don't know about you, but when I hear billion-dollar, I get motivated already. And trust me when I tell you, this guy's energy is contagious. So head over to True Underdog Podcast now to hear Jason and his high-profile guest turn their lives around to achieve massive success. Subscribe to True Underdog Podcast using Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you steal your favorite podcasts. Let's dive in, James. Let's get the uncomfortable part out of the way first. Let's deal with death.
Okay.
So way back when I met you in Kansas City, I was doing stand-up. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
You were talking to me about the Unbookables. And mm-hmm. I came back, I watched the movie with Doug, and I recommend people go see it. You come off as quite the asshole in that, but you're a likable asshole in a weird way. and you were like, hey, it would be great to get the group back together and do stand-up together. So I was going to give you guys one of my nights at the Comedy Store. I had a monthly night
there. Right.
I had dedicated an entire night to, you know, I believe it was in March, actually. Where we had it, or March or April, and we had it scheduled. March. We had the posters built out. You were like, wait, they're actually going to let us go to the Comedy Store? I'm like, it's my show. I can book whoever I want.
Right.
You were like, you didn't believe that I was going to let you guys in the Comedy Store. I gave you the night, and then that was the show that was on pace to happen, and that was the one we were about to do when everything got shut down because of COVID.
The lockdown started.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
So
it's horrible.
And since then, we've lost someone that was part of the production.
Yeah. The director of the movie, Jeff Pearson, passed away. And he had cancer for like a year and a half, and he didn't tell anybody. You know, he just told, you know, his wife's parents knew, and that was about it. But then he told me eventually, and then I found out about it. And I was, so I got a chance to talk to him. You know, a couple, two or three times before he passed, so I felt lucky to do that.
Yeah,
he was a real hero of mine.
Yeah, he was
I looked up to him. I mean, I've known the guy since like 1995.
Wow. Yeah, I'd only talked to him over the phone and shared text messages with him. He seemed like a really cool guy, and he was actually going to give me some footage.
Right.
From
Sean Rouse.
Of Sean, who had died. So what we were going to do, because Sean was the one who couldn't be there because, of course, he was dead. So what we were going to do is play some material that Jeff had filmed that had never been seen before of Sean. And we were even renting a projector, and we were going to project Sean onto the stage.
And see, the thing of it is, Jeff was going to go do that. Even though, but see, when COVID came out, he called me and said, dude, I'm not going because at the time he had cancer and of course, he didn't tell anyone about it. But after COVID came out, he was like, I'm not going to be at that show. And then a few weeks later, that's when the lockdown started. But go ahead.
Yeah. But even then he even told me he was going to send me the footage. Like on a USB drive or something, I was going to be able to plug it in and play Sean at the show. And so when I found out Jeff died as well, I was just like, you guys must be really hurting over that. It was so sad to hear that news.
It was, yeah. It was, I really honestly, I went through some mourning, which I didn't really know that I was mourning, but I started losing my memory. And, luckily I wasn't drinking or anything, you know, cause I probably drink about once a month or once every 2 months, I'll have some beers. But I remember calling one of my friends and telling him about Jeff dying. And then a week later I called the same friend and said, hey, have you heard the news? He's like, I go, Jeff died. And he's like, dude, you told me that last week. And I was like, oh my God, I completely forgot.
Wow.
And it was strange. And so I told my girlfriend, who's a therapist, she's been a therapist she's got a master's degree in clinical psychology. And she's like, yeah, when you're mourning, you can lose your memory.
Wow. Like, weird. I didn't know that.
I know. I mean, this guy was one of my a real close friend of mine, and so I should have remembered that I already called him, but I didn't.
You know, when
I was completely sober too.
When you're grieving, until you experience a loss of someone that close to you, like I did with my son, you don't really know how you're going to react to it. You don't understand. Mm-hmm. And you hear, this bullshit of time heals all wounds. No, it doesn't. And grief, mm-hmm. grief comes in waves. It mm-hmm. It hits you and then it goes away. And then it hits you and then it goes away. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it'll be 3 minutes and then it goes away, or 10 minutes, or it might be 2 or 3 days and then it goes away.
Yeah.
But it just, mm-hmm. and sometimes, and I know this sounds weird, I don't know if you've experienced this, and this happened with my dad as well. My dad just died like a year and a half ago. Maybe it's been 2 years now. No, yeah, June will mm-hmm. be 2 years. I forget sometimes that he's gone.
Uh-huh, yes.
Like it's such a bizarre feeling. And when it happened with my dad, I made a bit out of it and started doing stand-up talking about it. I don't know if
I saw that.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know if I'll be able to do that with my son or not. I think it's a little too close. But there is something about that to where you just kind of forget, and then you see something and it reminds you, oh, I need to tell them. And then it's almost like you have to be reminded again that the person's gone. And it's brutal, man, that mm-hmm. our brains do that to us. You know? Uh-huh.
Yeah. Well, I don't think it's really hit me that hard about Jeff. I mean, like I said, he was one of my heroes. I mean, he was one of those guys that when I hung out with him, he was always thinking that I was cool, and I was always thinking that he was cool. But we were all, both of us were like scared to hang out with each other. But he was the coolest guy you would ever. He had the coolest taste in clothes. We both loved Elvis Costello. That's what, when I found that out, I was like, oh my God, you're a big Elvis Costello fan? It's like, nobody likes Elvis, except me, And so we just got along just right off the bat when I first met him.
Wow. Speaking of Elvis Costello's band.
He changed my life. That guy, because he really? Made that movie, he decided to make that movie and just, it's a long story, but I mean, what really sucks about COVID and this lockdown is we weren't able to do a wake or a memorial or a funeral, and it just sucks so much.
Yeah. I mean, we did one for my son outdoors at the Santa Monica Pier, and everybody was
Was it during lockdown when you had to go through that?
Yeah, yeah. I called. He just died in November. He just died in November, man.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Two weeks before his 21st birthday.
Oh my God. That's like the worst. I mean, if it's 20, it's like, you never think that, your child is going to die. You always think your dad or your mom's going to die or your grandmother's going to die. It's just,
Yeah. And it's a long story. There's a whole thing. Like, I haven't talked about it publicly because it's pending an investigation, so I can't really speak on it yet. But when all the information becomes available, I don't mind sharing and talking about it. But it's been rough on everybody. The circumstances surrounding it were rough, and it's not a fun situation. But we were able to have at least a decent memorial service. I gave a eulogy. We were outdoors. And what we did for him, it was just – he was known for just basically just talking shit to people. Like he was just, he would just roast everybody. And he was really simple as far as like what he wanted in life. He just wanted, burgers, weed, and to work out and ride his motorcycle. Like he was not, he wasn't a bad guy. He wasn't trying to, screw anybody over. He wasn't. He was just a kid. He's 20 years old. And so we just got a bunch of chicken sandwiches and sat around and talked about him. And anybody who ever has gone to this formal funeral where you're wearing a suit and a tie, and it's miserable. It's miserable for everybody there. It's sad. It's terrible. Yeah. And then once, the coffin is lowered or the body is taken away, and then there's like 20 people sitting around with their ties off and their jackets are in the car, and they're sitting around having a beer with their feet up talking about the person. That to me is the real shit. That's when you're really sharing real stuff. And so that's essentially what we tried to create with, right. with my son. Is,
yeah.
And I said that as part of the eulogy. I said, we're going to skip the formal stuff that, that he would have hated. We're just going to sit around and eat chicken sandwiches and Takis, his favorite
and
foods.
You, yeah, I
and
know.
And we're just going to talk about it. And people told jokes and talked about how this one guy got up, who's this heavyset guy, was like, well, he nicknamed me Fat Boy. And he's like, he's always trying to get me to go to the gym. And we just talked about real life. And to me, that was the best way to honor him. You know, and then his riding buddies that he rode his motorcycle with, they actually took his ashes and took him on a last ride through Santa Monica and dumped a portion of his ashes at his favorite place to ride. And it's just a really emotional situation for me. But yeah, I mean, we honored him the best way we could, you know, in COVID. Everybody was masked up and socially distanced. But to me, you know, the only way you can live on now is in memories. And so I've contacted Instagram to hold his Instagram account as a deceased person so that they won't get deleted for inactivity. So it's like an in-memory account or something now. But anyway. Did you have some?
Well, I just, it's been my experience that it just, it's all subjective to how and when the person passed on.
Yeah.
When my friend Matt, who was one of my best friends in high school, committed suicide, that was one kind of mourning. And when my father, who was 82 years old, at 40, the doctor told him, if you don't fix your eating habits and your exercising habits, you'll be dead in 5 years. My dad did nothing. And died, having never been in the hospital a day in his life, never sick a day in his life, died of a massive heart attack in front of the TV watching Fox News at 82. You know, it's like it was a totally different feeling. Like, honest to goodness, and I've told many people this as an atheist, a non-spiritual person, this is a story that many people are like, wait a second, but it's true. When my sister called me and said, last night, Dad died. The first thing that happened was I heard as clear as could be my dad's voice say, it's okay, Michael. It's
Are you serious?
Yes. I heard it as clear
what,
as could
really?
Be. I don't think my dad as spirit was speaking to me. I think it was my brain telling me that is what Dad would have said. That is what Dad would have said. And in fact, the story I told my siblings, again, as an atheist, a strange story, but to make them feel better, I said, look, if before Dad was born, he's up in heaven. And St. Peter says, hey, hey, all the guys that are never going to exercise, eat anything they want, and never follow a doctor's orders, come here. We're going to figure out how long you live for. We're going to roll some dice. Dave, you live to, 35, rough stuff. Joe rolls the dice, 56. Lou, that's my dad, rolls the dice, 80 fucking two. 80 to like, dude, he won the lottery. My dad never did anything the doctor said, never exercised. He, his favorite thing in the world was pizza with the cheese in the crust. That's every time you're my dad, he's like, let's get that pizza with the cheese in the crust. Like, Dad, you should not be eating the pizza with the cheese in the crust. Had never been in the hospital, had never had surgery, died of a massive heart attack. My dad was a huge Trump supporter. Different story altogether. Died in front of Fox News. I say, win. That's the way to do it, man. If you're going to live a life, that's that was a good one. He came in, did what he wanted, and died doing what he wanted. My friend Matt, who I love very much, one of my best friends, when I got the word that
when you said win just now, I was like, what?
Yeah.
I thought you were saying win, one less Trump supporter.
Like,
terrible. I was like, holy shit.
He was a winner. He went out like a winner.
Yeah, I get it. I get it now.
The way he wanted. But and then when I got the call that my friend Matt, who I love very dearly, no fucking around. This dude meant it. When he said, I don't want to be here anymore, he meant it. He put a gun in his mouth and he pulled fucking trigger. God. That's a totally different kind of mourning.
Yeah.
That's a totally different, like, oh, dude, you know?
So, yeah, sometimes I mean, when people, there are people who struggle, you know, with, you know, severe COPD for years and years and years and years. And the family wakes up every morning terrified that something's going to happen. And you know that they're struggling. You know that they're suffering. It's some kind of painful disease or disorder. They're having trouble breathing. They're on oxygen. When this goes on and on and on and on, at some point, and this may sound really morbid, but at some point when the person dies, there's a sense of relief that they're not struggling. They're not in pain. I don't have to panic every time the phone rings. Like, they're not hurting anymore. You know, there's that bit of it too. I've seen family members go through that to where you know, the people are, they get down to nothing and they're 91 pounds and they used to be a bodybuilder. You know, it's so sad, you know, the human condition mm-hmm. of that, and having to process that with different worldviews, I think is really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think maybe my whole view on death started probably because the first funeral that I went to was of a suicide. So when I was a kid, like 10 or 12, my dad's best friend killed himself. And so I remember my dad telling me about it. And, you know, he's like, we got to go to the funeral. And I went to this funeral and, you know, you just feel it in the room. Everyone was just really depressed, you know, because, and at the time I didn't really know. I just, you know, it was my first funeral, but, you know, since then I've been to a lot of funerals and they're not all the same, but a suicide is hard to take. Yeah. And so since after that, I started getting this really this intense fear of death ever since I can look back, you know, when I was a kid, 16, 17, 18, it's all I just obsessed over it.
Yeah.
That's funny. I've never feared death so much as I fear dying without accomplishing anything.
Right.
Uh-huh. And I'll hear from mm-hmm. people that say, oh, you've had an impact in my life and I appreciate you. And that feels amazing. And I wonder if I were to suddenly come down with something now, is that going to be in my head? Am I going to be happy about that? Cause I have so much more that I want to get done. Like, I just don't want to die, with a to-do list.
Right.
But I make one every day.
Yeah.
So,
well, they
you
say,
know what I mean?
They say even Da Vinci on his deathbed, he felt like he didn't do enough. I'm like, dude, yeah. You're Da Vinci. Usually the brilliant artists are the ones that are always thinking they're not doing enough. They could be better and I got to try harder. I mean, that's what I always felt when I was in comedy. Every time I got off stage, I was like, oh, I could have been funnier if I would have just said this instead of that. You know, yeah. Just rarely do I ever have a good show. Or, I mean, rarely do I feel like I had a good show, you know?
Right.
So I'm so hard on myself.
The one thing that gets, I don't know, I had this revelation when I first lost my faith in my mid-20s, which was you can't be dead. You can right. only be dying.
Yeah.
There's no one there to be dead.
Right.
You're not there. You're not dead. You're not in a state of being that is right. dead. You're not, you can't be dead. You can only be dying. The death is nothing to fear because it's.
Was it Mark Twain quote? I was dead for thousands of years before I existed and I wasn't inconvenienced
yeah.
one bit.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I hate to be the devil's advocate, but I got a story for you, but go ahead.
No, I've said my piece. Please, let's hear the story.
Well, I went to a couple Buddhist monasteries, you know, because I mean, I kind of lost my faith, I guess. I started studying religion. I studied all the world's religions and I really got into Buddhism. And I just read almost every book I could get my hands on. And finally, I was like, I'm going to go to a monastery. And so one of the monasteries that I went to, they taught this a technique called Vipassana. And so, you know, it takes a while to learn how to do it. And, you know, it's you go to these 10-day retreats. And I always felt like I didn't really learn it in 10 days. You know, maybe if I just stay here and keep doing it, you know, I'll get it down, you know, pat to where I know I'm doing it right, you know. And sure enough, I stayed there. And after like, I don't know, I'd say about a month and a half, maybe it was, no, I'd say about, after about 3 weeks, I really figured it out. Like, oh, this is what it is. You know, you're doing this meditation and it has no, there's no mantra. There's no God to believe in. There's no, you're not chanting anything, you know, you're not staring at an orange or anything. You got your eyes closed and you got your mind still, you know, you're slowing everything down. Your heart rate slows down. Your breathing slows down, you know, and your mind, you stop thinking about the past and you stop thinking about the future. You don't have any thoughts in your head, but you're still awake. You're still sitting there. And so we would meditate like 8 hours a day or sometimes 5 hours a day. But in one of those hours, it was a whole hour of me just being completely in a mental state of samadhi or whatever they call it, you know. And I started seeing like little flashes of my life, like, oh, I remember I had that one bicycle or oh, I remember that kid down the street. I totally forgot that notebook that I had, that green notebook. And, oh, I had that little toy. What the? And so I started to see these little images, and they weren't like, I wasn't creating these thoughts myself. I mean, I was just watching this stuff. And I remember like kind of thinking it was a little weird. I went to the teacher and I said, hey, you know, something weird's happening to me. I'm starting to see like, you know, images of my life, you know, that, and he's like, yeah, that's supposed to happen, but, you know, don't go around, you know, telling people about it and don't get attached to it. You know, it happens. And so when I left and I went back into society, I was reading books and I was reading some book about a near death experience. And they're talking about how people get close to death, like, if they almost get in a car wreck or they die on the operating table, they see their life flash before their eyes. And I was like, oh man, that's what happened to me. I mean, I went into such a deep meditative state where you're just stopping everything. And you just, you get into insight into like who you are, like, this is who you are. And they say that you, sometimes you have that same experience when you're taking DMT, you know? I slowed down my mind so much that I actually had a life review.
Yeah. Now there's something, yeah. There's definitely something in the brain. Yeah,
absolutely.
There's definitely something. I had someone on several years ago, who was a specialist in near-death experiences and explained all sorts of technical stuff that happens. Like when people experience that level of peace right before their death, and, you know, religious people will definitely ascribe that to, or assign that to, I should say, something like, well, the angels came to get him and that's why he was safe.
Uh-huh.
Things like that. Uh-huh. You know? But there's definitely something that goes on in the brain.
Well, to me, the reason I got into Buddhism, because Buddhism doesn't say that there's angels or doesn't tell you that there's anything after death, or, you know, it's more like, look, this is stuff that happens in your mind. It doesn't matter if it's real or not. It matters because it's happening in your own brain. So that's the important part in Buddhism. Everything is the mind in Buddhism, you know. So they don't see the world the way we do in the Western, you know, where we have God or we have logic and reason. You know, in the Eastern world, you know, they have a completely different way of looking at the world.
Yeah, and I find it very beneficial as well. I go to, from time to time, this is before pandemic though, because my fiance likes to go, and I go with her on Sunday mornings to the SRF here in town, which is a self-realization fellowship, which is...
What is that? Is it like a UU or...?
It's kind of hard to describe, but they have a beautiful temple out by up on the one freeway up on the PCH right off of there as you're leaving Santa Monica.
Okay.
Is it Vedanta?
Well, it's called the SRF. God, the founder was, I mean, it's not, I just go with her, but it's.
I just go for the cookies.
They do have cookies and lemonade, actually. But they have gorgeous grounds that you walk. But you, it's all about meditating. It's all about...
It's Yogananda.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yogananda. Okay. Thank you.
What is that? What is Yogananda?
Yogananda was a person. He started Self-Realization Fellowship.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
And it's a big part of it is meditation. And I did learn the meditation techniques about looking, you know, to your third eye, between your eyes. You can, and I can get it to happen where they say you'll see a little blue star. I will get the little blue star going when I do a deep meditation. And there's no doubt about that, the breathing, the meditating, it has a calming and clarifying effect on the mind. Russell Brand talks about it. Actually, David Lynch talks about it as well. Transcendental meditation.
I think Sam Harris talks about it as well with his mindfulness. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I've always struggled.
I mean,
I've always struggled.
Big into Zen, isn't he?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I've always struggled with meditating. I that's one thing I really want to accomplish before my near death experience. Because I've never been able to turn it off. I can't shut the brain up. And I've had different people go, I'll take you, I'll show you. I even had a sponsor that was meditation apps. And I had a coach assigned to me that I was trying to learn to meditate and turn it off. And my brain is just so, like, it's constantly either writing, kind of one of their.
Yeah. I mean, well, but see, this is one of the reasons why the Buddha created the Sangha. There's three jewels in Buddhism. There's the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. The Sangha is the society of monks, and he has all these rules about what to do at the monastery. But I'll tell you this much. If you want to learn meditation, and if you go to one of these places, you're forced to learn it because you're sitting there and you can't move.
I feel like I would go insane. Like I feel like my brain, and I want to try, but I feel like my brain is either constantly creating, constantly planning for the business side of the creation, writing. Book type material.
You're not psychotic. I mean, I'm sure you can learn how to do it. I don't know, man.
Well, let me finish this, James.
All right.
So either writing something like, you know, business related, writing a screenplay idea or jokes, or thinking about planning doing one of those things. And if I'm not doing one of those things, I'm instantly filled with guilt that I'm not doing one of those things and I don't feel productive. When people say things like, oh man, I'm going to retire and you're going to see me on a beach drinking a Mai Tai. That sounds like prison to me. Sitting on a beach with nothing but an alcoholic drink, maybe for an hour and a half, maybe. But I'd start shifting my feet, wondering where my notepad was. Can I get to my laptop? Should we record a conversation? I would feel useless.
You're not really doing nothing when you're meditating. There's a lot of strenuous, it's not easy. I mean, so it's like doing but not doing. That's the Taoist in the Tao Te Ching. They have a phrase called Wu Wei, and Wu Wei means doing by not doing. So there's a lot of strenuous effort that goes into meditation, but go ahead.
that just sounds like some pothead's excuse for not working, for not sweeping at Burger King.
I've been there.
That's what you would think, you know, but I'm telling you that I guess in Buddhism, they talk about what are the results? I mean, how does it affect you in a practical way? Yeah. And you are supposed to kind of see with your own eyes what works for you and what doesn't work for you. But I used to study the Tao Te Ching, and there's something about where you sit and do nothing for like an hour. You get up and you're ready to do all kinds of stuff.
Really? That's cool.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're in that zone. Yeah. It sounds like a battery recharge. It sounds like it would be really good for me if I could figure it out. But anytime I've gone and put the headphones on, and I've gone to, there's like a place called 10,000 Waves in New Mexico. I've gone to several places where I just sit on a pillow next to some Zen master and I put the headphones on to listen to ocean waves, and I clear my mind and I take a deep breath and go, I didn't file my taxes. I got to make a note. I got to get my phone. Let me get my phone. I'll make a note real quick. Oh, and then once I make the note, then I'll be fine. Then I make the note and then I put the phone away. Yeah. Okay. I'm going to clear my mind. I'm going to be fine. I never sent my mom that gift card. Shit. Let me write that down.
You're literally doing it wrong. And you're actually giving the reason why you should get good at it.
I know. I'm admitting that I'm terrible at it.
You're telling us that you want to do it.
I am. I want to figure out how to do it right. And it's something that it's always a struggle to get my brain to shut the hell up.
Like, me too. And having worked on it a little bit, and again, this is not something I sought out. This was something I did to be a good partner in a relationship. This is something that means a lot to my fiance that we go and we do these meditations. And I have found that like when it starts to happen, you're like, wow, quieting the mind is good for
the mind.
It's good for the creative process.
Is that why you're 10 minutes late to every podcast? Because you're doing it by not doing it?
That's right. I'm doing this podcast right now by not doing it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I look at it like driving a car. Like if you had a car and it only had a gas pedal and it didn't have any brakes, you wouldn't really be able to drive that car.
That's good.
If you're going to drive a car, and you come up to a corner, you got to put on the brakes so you can go somewhere. And to me, meditation is just, it's your brakes in a car where if you need to stop, you can stop. And if you need to go, you can go. I know how to use my mind. I know how to stop my mind,
Hey, when we do our sets in San Diego in June, whichever dates we end up settling on, I'm just going to sit on stage for about 5 minutes.
Yeah.
The first 5 minutes of my first set, I'm going to do nothing. And when they're booing and they're mad and you're in the back embarrassed, I'm going to go, Michael, I'm doing stand-up by not doing stand-up.
Yeah.
Actually, no, wait a second. Now, you're not, when you're not doing stand-up, that is a very good point that you brought up, because when you're up there and you're just telling jokes robotically, like a machine, like here I am, right. I'm David Smalley telling a joke, but
oh my God, he's heard my set.
Not telling a joke, you're in that moment, you're in the zone, and right. you tell the joke, and you're not really self-conscious, you're not thinking about it. You know, a lot of times, like, you can't drive a car. If you sat there and thought about all the things you have to do to drive a car, you learn how to drive a car, eventually you get it, and there's this other part of your brain that just takes over, and you know how to drive a car. You don't have to think how to
drive a car. That's a good reason. That's why teenagers are so terrible at driving. They know everything there is, and they think they have to consciously think about every bit of it. You're exactly right. I get it. I was joking, James. But yeah, I think that that's something I want to look into, because I've always struggled with that, and I want to. I think
in God to meditate.
Yeah, you know? I know. I think that if I figure out the meditation aspect, I will probably be even more productive when I am conscious of my actions. I'm open to it. I don't like the spirituality portion of it, but
I know. Personally, I'm just like you. I couldn't stand some of those people at Vipassana. They seemed like they were really like kind of fundamentalist Vipassana. You know, I'm like, I'm always going to be who I am. I learned this technique. I learned how to meditate. And when I got back into society, I was still the same person. You know, I just knew more about myself.
And Michael, you concur?
I think so.
Do you still meditate, like, to this day?
We do, yes. We do ones at night as we're going to bed. Sometimes we'll put on a meditation. And I very often just fall asleep. So... I'm trying. She'll do the whole meditation, and then she'll finish up and look over at me and be like, oh, you're out cold. Never mind.
She's like, I'm becoming a better person. Yeah. You're drooling.
Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Now, just to wrap up the death conversation, I do want to say that when we left my son's memorial service, we walked up on top of the pier, and we're going to go stand out on the edge of the pier and look at the ocean. And which is the last picture I have taken with him, by the way. That's where we were standing. So we were walking out that way, and my daughter, Talissa, looks back and notices this woman is struggling with a dog. Like this, it's a pretty large dog, and she can't really, he's trying to walk, make him walk, and he's standing there with one leg up and he's not really moving. And she goes, I think she needs help. And I turn around and I see what she's talking about. And sure enough, there's this woman who just can't get the dog to move. And when you're on that pier, for anybody who knows, it's long. And we were pretty far out there. And it's a long walk to the front of that pier to even get to the street. And then there's this very steep incline. I'm sure you've done it before, right, Michael? The very steep incline to get out of it. And then crossing a street. And then that's where all the parking is, inside of a parking garage with multiple levels. So you're talking easily a 20-minute walk from the edge of the pier to any vehicle that is going to be parked somewhere. And most of it uphill or across wood. And so I walk over and I go, hey, are you okay? Do you need any help? And she's like, this is my dog's last day on the planet. And I brought him out to the ocean because he loves being here. And he's got really bad hip dysplasia. He's very, very old. He's had multiple surgeries and treatments, and it's just time to stop his suffering. So he has an appointment in the morning to be put down, and I just wanted to bring him here. So I brought him, and now he's in pain and can't walk back to the car, and I don't know what to do.
Oh, man.
And it was an easy no-brainer for us. Talissa and I looked at each other. I was like, look like we're carrying a dog. So I pet him for a second and lifted this dog up, and I walked him as far as I could, which was all the way the length of the pier and about 3/4 of the way up that steep incline out of it. And my back started getting out. I mean, this dog's probably every bit of, I don't know, 75 yeah. to 80 pounds.
Yeah, and I was like, do it without crying.
Yeah, I was like, geez. Oh yeah, it was tough. And I'm allergic to dogs, by the way, I should say. And so we had our masks on, and the masks had my son on it doing a wheelie on his motorcycle, like this outline of it, and had his name on it. So we were talking to her that we were there for a memorial service, and we carried this dog all the way. And then I shifted. My son's best friend from his childhood flew out from Texas to be a part of the memorial service. So he carried him for a while. Him and Talissa carried him, and we just basically took turns until we got all the way to her car. We put the dog in the car, swapped info. I got her phone number. And if anyone wants to see the dog, there's actually a picture. It's the main cover photo on my Twitter. So if you just go to twitter.com/DavidCSmalley, you'll see Talissa and me and Peyton with the dog right there.
I think
there.
I saw that. I was like, wonder what that.
Yeah, that's the dog. Huh, if you look to the on the left of our masks, that's the memorial mask we were all wearing for my son. But that dog was so damn sweet. And it was good to be there for that woman in that tough time, you know.
Oh, my God. But that's why you're making me cry right now. Jesus.
Yeah, a lot of people don't. I've never talked about why that picture is there or what that means, but that's what that's actually about. So, and I stayed in touch with her. She, what she ended up doing is, I think a day or two later, after she took the dog in and he was no longer here, she went and made a donation to the adoption center where she adopted the dog several years before. She made a donation to that place in my son's name.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, wow, so, that's incredible.
Came full circle.
What a weird coincidence. I mean,
yeah.
Wow. Huh. Yeah.
It's a pretty cool situation. Yeah, so.
Yeah.
I mean, that to me, that's making the best of an absolute... two terrible situations coming together and having the most positive end result, you know?
Yeah. So. Like a weird synchronistic, coincidental, strange thing that happened. Yeah. And man, I mean, that just,
yeah. What I'm saying is if you get in a situation like that, you know, I know it's tough, it's rough on everybody, but there is some good that can be done out of it. You know what I mean?
That's a whole different thing.
It's hard. I still haven't really faced the whole fact of yeah.
What are you gonna say, Michael? Hold on. What are you gonna say?
Oh, I was just gonna say that having been in that situation as well, that is unique to pets. Obviously, we don't have that with friends and relatives. But making an appointment with the vet to put a pet down, a loved pet, and then that last day with them, and then calling them to put them in the carrier to take them to the vet.
They have no idea,
and you're like, this is it, old friend. And then I just put one of my kitties down about a year ago. She was 18 and she was a sweetheart, but yeah, it's so weird. And just that, come on, got to get you in the pet carrier. Here we go. You don't know where we're going, but
I mean, yeah,
you don't, it's a weird feeling.
Well, I mean, I didn't want to do that with our last dog, Chloe. You know, I did take her, you know, to the vet, and I said, look, she's in some pain, so can't you give her some, like, arthritis pills or something? I mean, I don't want to put her down, but, you know, obviously she's got some kind of arthritis. And so the doctor said, okay, here you go. Here's some arthritis pills for dogs, and here's some, some other pain pill or something. And I gave it to her, and she goes, when I took her out to go pee, she started running around the front yard. And I'm like, oh my gosh, that was the only problem. I thought she was going to die. It turns out she just got really bad arthritis. So she lived another 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And I almost put her down, you know? Oh my God.
I've seen people, like when I bought my first house in Texas back in 2006, the people that we bought the house from had this collie that was blind, and it knew its way around that house. It would walk, to a certain spot, and it would barely tap its nose against the wall, and it would turn. And they were like, yeah, we're moving to a new house, and this dog's not going to, you know, it's going to be hard for this dog to figure out its way around things. So we're just going to go have it put down. And I was like, wait, what?
Oh man.
Like, no, there's going to be a learning curve. You don't have to put that dog. And I felt so, I almost didn't want to buy the house, 'cause I knew that they were selling and then going to, you know, put this dog down. And
Yeah.
It was so bad. Oh, and of course, the wife made the husband go do it by himself. So he came back and was just a mess. We were like at the house. He comes home and he's just a mess. He's crying. Wow. He's like, we shouldn't have done that. It was, and I was like, oh my God, this is so super awkward.
Wow.
I was like,
Well, the other weird thing that happened with Chloe was she was getting really bad. I was giving her the pills and there was one day where she couldn't really walk very good just to go to the bathroom. And that's when I brought it up to Brenda. I was like, Brenda, we probably should start looking for a vet to, you know, put her down. And Brenda gets on the phone and she's on the phone. I'm in the other room. And she's looking up for a vet. And then Chloe just died right then and there. And I was like, wow, that was easy. I mean, you know, just had a little problem walking for one day. And then right when we were going to take her to put her down, she just passed naturally. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Wow.
I have to tell you that one time, this is like 3 years ago now, my friend calls me up and is like, will you watch my cat for a month while I'm going out of town?
Oh, shit.
I said, sure.
Oh.
Happy to help.
I'm uncomfortable. I'm shifting in my chair.
Yeah.
Because I'm already uncomfortable.
So I go to watch her cat. Day one, I realize immediately the only thing I could do for this cat is have it put down. This cat is clearly sick and dying and old. I call my friend. I'm like, your cat is in physical pain. Clearly. She's like, well, I wasn't sure. I'm like, no, I'm sure. This cat is, it was blind for one. And it just yelped in pain all night long.
How many times did you step on it?
Very funny. So long story short, I said, look, the only thing I could do for you is to bring your cat to have it put down. So word of advice to anyone listening. When you go to have a cat put down, I show up. I said, I'm here to have this cat put down.
Hold on. Let me get this straight. You are watching the cat while the person is out of town.
Yeah.
And you are the one overseeing the cat's death.
Yes.
So she did not say, wait until I get back home. I want to be there.
No, she said, you're right. I mean, the cat was already blind.
You're
she
right. I've seen the cat enough. I kissed it on its head.
Oh, my God.
You can have it.
She probably didn't
down.
Want to deal with it.
It's better than watching a cat die for a month. Would have even made it for a month.
That's an interesting concept.
Yeah.
Hey, will you take my dog and have it put down? I don't want to deal with it. I mean, maybe so.
Who knows? If subconsciously she was like, look, this cat's dying. I don't want to deal with it. Send Regilio in. But this cat, I mean, the vet vouched for me eventually. But here's the point of the story. When you bring a cat to be brought down, I said, look, I'm here to have the cat brought down, put down. And the receptionist, we understand. You just have to fill out some paperwork. So she pulls out some paperwork, starts asking me some questions. When they get to I can't remember what the question was, but don't say, I don't know. It's not my cat. When you're bringing it to be brought, put down. She literally goes to the other room. I can hear her talking to the doctor. She's like, I think he just wants to kill a cat.
Oh, no. Oh,
fuck. Doctor comes out. He's like, look, normally we don't do this, but I have to give this cat a full examination before I'm willing to put it down.
Oh, man.
He takes me in the other room. Cat's still in the box. And he says to me, this is no joke. This is no joke.
The funniest thing I've ever heard you say, including all of your stand-up.
Thank you.
Don't say, I don't know.
Yeah. Doctor says to me, doctor says to me,
I just found this poor
I'm
bastard.
Not going to open that carrier and find a healthy cat. Am I? I was like, dude, no, look, you guys have me all wrong. And so he opens the cat. He feels the cat's belly. He says there's a major blockage in the intestines. This cat is in severe pain. It's blind. The cat had gone to the bathroom in the carrier at the time. He examined that and he's like, no, this cat needs to be put down.
He heard you discussing his murder.
Yeah. Yeah. So that said, doctor puts the cat down, and I did not do this, but I can't tell you how much as I was leaving, I wanted to turn to that receptionist and go, hey, I'm coming back in an hour with another cat and I don't want any guff out of you. Okay.
Oh man. You're like the cat Grim Reaper.
Yeah. But yeah, do not say, I don't know. It's not my cat. When you brought it to the vet to be put down.
What the listener and James didn't see was your body language. Your hands went up like, I don't know, it's not my cat. Like,
I suddenly, saw that. I could imagine that. It's like that.
Suddenly he was so indifferent. He's like, I care about this animal. It needs to be put down immediately. It's in a lot of pain. Man. What's its name? Yeah. I don't know. I don't think the question was what's its name. It was like about the cat's health, but I was just like, I don't know. It's not my cat. I'm just here to kill it. Lady, what is with the third degree? Jeez, can we just, what do you do? Man. Hit it, inject it, do it.
I'm just here to kill it.
Oh my God. That reminded me of two other stories. And one, you know, I my roommate was a grown man and he had a cat that was sick and died, and he couldn't deal with it. Like, you know, it was in the other room, and he's like, I come home, I was on the road or something, and he asked me if I could bury the cat for him because he just could not do it. He said it would just like break down and cry and all this. So here's just part of the story. Since I already told you I was a Buddhist, I have like certain Tibetan prayers memorized, you know. So I took the cat out behind the apartment and I dig a hole and I bury this cat and I say a bunch of Tibetan Buddhist prayers for this cat. And then around that same time, my girlfriend's cat died and a garage door fell on this cat and just killed it right at. Jeepers. And so they're like, we're going to take the cat out and bury it in the backyard. And so I went out with her mom, her dad and her, and they're very religious family. Right. And so we're standing around this little cat grave and they all said a prayer. They all each said a prayer and they looked at me, right? Like, James, do you want to say a prayer? I look at him and go, well, I have this Tibetan prayer. Do you want me to say it? They're like, sure, go ahead. I go, it takes about 2.5 minutes. And they're like, that's okay. So I go into this Tibetan prayer, and when I get out of it, I go into a trance whenever I do this prayer. And I open my eyes, and they were just staring at me like, oh my God, our daughter is dating a demon. Because if you ever read the Tibetan Book of the Dead, it's pretty intense, you know. And that was kind of an interesting experience.
Wow. So, I thought you were going to say you opened your eyes and the cat was working its way out of the grave.
No, like, no, the cat was dead. Great. Yeah. Yeah, the cat, that prayer great. Was
That's a hell of a prayer. Cat. Pet cemetery. Sometimes dead is better.
So I tweeted on April 13th. I said something, and some people got a little stirred up about it. I don't know if you saw this, Rogelio.
I don't think I did.
I said, I know I'm supposed to be the nice guy, but I'm so sick of Christians pretending to be, quote, all about science. No, you're not. The core of your faith, from Jesus' healing powers to the resurrection to walking on water to raising Lazarus from the dead, all defies basic physics.
Uh-huh.
James Inman replied, oh, dude, I can easily debate you on this one. When are we going to do a podcast again when you don't call in sick? Because I did. I canceled a show one day because I was sick. I love that reply, and that's what we're going to get into. But we're going to do it in the Patreon portion of the show. Because he is going to defend this concept. And I know there are people that are going to be upset with me for having this view. Yes, I know that there are people who study science that also claim to be Christians. I'm going to talk about that specific contradiction in the extended version of the show at patreon.com/DavidCSmalley. Come over there and join us. James, give them your Twitter real quick before we go behind the wall.
It's _James_Inman.
He means so underscore.
James Inman. Yeah, on Twitter. _James_Inman. That's me.
It's underscore, but that's what you mean. Yeah. Underscore.
Oh, James. Underscore. Yeah.
Underscore James underscore Inman. INMAN. Any other websites you want to point them to?
Just watch my movie. It's not my movie. It's Jeff Pearson, you know, it's called The Unbookables, or you can find it on Amazon. You can find it on iTunes, and it's all over the place. Just type it into Google. It's streaming, and it's called Doug Stanhope's The Unbookables.
Yeah. All right, cool. So we are headed over to Patreon right now to have this discussion about just how scientific are Christians. There are tons of Christians who come on the show and go, I'm a man of science. And then they proceed to tell me Christian arguments about Jesus waking from the dead. And I always just accept it and say, well, let's move on from this. And then I've been texting with youth pastor John Gary. I've been texting with him about it. And he's like, yeah, I accept science. But then when we start diving into these stories, there are things he believes about the Bible that require the outright rejection of science in order to accept them. So I'm ready to have this fun, lively debate. Let's do it. We're headed over to Patreon. If you're not coming with us, please at least drive like you know each other.
Glad we got in the plug for my Twitter handle.
Your Twitter handle's terrible. What is it? Michael Regilio 1?
Yeah.
Who puts a number in their Twitter?
The guy that's cousin already took at Michael Regilio.
Call him. Do you have his number?
No. Never met the gentleman.
Offer to buy it from him. He has like 3 tweets. There's 0 activity on it.
Yeah.
Let's just get it for him. Let's get at Michael Regilio from him.
All right.
Yeah.
And then you'll plug it in the free half?
Yes. When it's an actual Twitter handle, I'll plug it. So far, it's terrible, and I'm never going to let an episode go out with Michael Regilio 1 on it. It's terrible. It's the number 1, right? Yeah.